Very appreciative of that kind introduction, but only wish you had grabbed me 12 years ago. It would have been a renewed acquaintance then instead of a new acquaintance. It's a great honor to be asked to present the J.J. Thiessen Lectures at Canadian Mennonite University, just as it's a real privilege to try to say some things about Canada to a Canadian audience. The passage of Scripture is meant to draw attention to the New Testament's affirmation of what we might consider positive in the realms of culture, which will be the broad subject of my lectures here. But the passage ends in verse 9, as I'm sure you heard, with the prayer to the God of peace would prevail. And so that's a very nice passage for a place like Canadian Mennonite University. I'm also pleased that we could sing a hymn by Margaret Clarkson this morning, who is one of the great modern gifts of Canada to the worldwide English-speaking church. Although as we were singing, I did reflect that I believe Margaret Clarkson's papers are at Wheaton College, which might be another instance of the Yankees stealing the bacon from a Canadian audience. It does mean a great deal for me to offer these lectures under Mennonite auspices in Winnipeg. I know a little bit about the evangelical history of this city because of a very fine essay on the Elam Chapel early in the 20th century, written by Regent College's Bruce Hindmarsh, whom I consider one of the world's best historians of the evangelical tradition. I know a little bit more about the Mennonites of Winnipeg because of my friend Paul Heiderbrecht and what he has told me about growing up among the Mennonite brethren of this city. Paul was for many years an elder and then associate pastor of the Presbyterian Church where we were members in Wheaton, Illinois. Although Paul had become more of a Calvinist than he was when he lived in Winnipeg, he retained an awful lot of his Mennonite heritage, so much so that our church was distinguished in Presbyterian circles for its associate pastor, who, though a Calvinist, remained a really serious pacifist as well. Thanks also to the network centered in Winnipeg, I also have a better grasp of Canadian life in general and Canadian religious life in particular. For many years, I've been an appreciative reader of Christian Week, which because of the faithful labors of Harold Jantz and Douglas Coop and their associates have succeeded in providing a rich mixture of information, insight, and edification. Now, these are three words that you don't get to put together very often for publications. So I'm very pleased to begin by expressing public thanks to a Canadian circle of influences that includes Bruce Hindmarsh, Paul Heiderbrecht, and all those who have worked together to publish Christian Week. I'm also grateful for the chance to offer these lectures because of the opportunity they afford to explain why, as an American, and as a historian working mostly with American and British subjects, I have found the study of Canadian history so rewarding. The four lectures take up two apparently different topics, though I hope they might eventually come together in the end. The first two concern the question of the character of Canada as a Christian nation and how that character has changed since the 1960s. This morning, I begin with an updated and abbreviated version of a lecture that has been published as a 2005 presidential address of the American Society of Church History and then was brought out as a pamphlet by Regent College Press. It tries to answer the question, what happened to Christian Canada? Tonight, I will stay with the same question, but try to rethink the broader historical and theological implications of the question itself. So this morning, I'm trying to approach the question as primarily an American historian, but tonight, primarily as a Christian believer. Tomorrow, I plan to offer two lectures on the scholarship and life of George Rolick, who was for many years a professor of history at Queen's University in Ontario and who was one of my main inspirations for becoming interested in Canadian history. The first of these lectures will update material I have published before in the outlines of George Rolick's career and what his historical scholarship on Canadian subjects might mean for general audiences, including Americans. The second lecture on George Rolick attempts the more difficult task of saying what I learned about Christian academic practice and Christian faith more generally from this larger-than-life figure. I know this is going to be a challenge for those of you who did not know about George Rolick, who never met him. George died 13 years ago this November, and so he is a figure now who is historical himself, as well as remaining an excellent historian through his books. But his presence still looms large over much of what I do as a Christian historian, and he does continue to influence a wide range of Canadians through his works and through his many students. At the very end of that second lecture tomorrow, I will try to draw together my thoughts on the broad question of Christian Canada and on the focused issue of George Rolick and his influence. As an American trying to understand a little about Canada, I know I'm only a Yankee, or I guess a Cub or a White Sox or whatever you like. I'm only an American looking north, but since that effort has meant so much to me, I'm delighted for the chance to try to say why. So, what happened to Christian Canada? By asking this question, I begin with an assumption that there was once a Christian Canada that is now gone. And I'll begin with a series of historical snapshots that, to me, drive home this conclusion. The first comes from the installation address of Georges Vanier in September 1959, when he was installed as the 19th Governor General of Canada. Vanier, a much decorated general, diplomat, and active Roman Catholic, began his acceptance speech like this: "Mr. Prime Minister, my first words are a prayer. May Almighty God, in his infinite wisdom and mercy, bless the sacred mission which has been entrusted to me by Her Majesty the Queen, and help me to fulfill it in all humility. In exchange for his strength, I offer him my weakness. May he give peace to this beloved land of ours, and to those who live in it, the grace of mutual understanding, respect, and love." 56 years later, on September 27, 2005, Michelle Jean became Canada's 27th Governor General. She is a multilingual, Haitian-born filmmaker and journalist, as many of you know. Her address was forward-looking and stressed, as had Vanier's, the importance of mutual toleration for Canada's social well-being. Otherwise, there were no themes in common. For Jean's primary concern was the exaltation of individual liberty. For her, Canada's history speaks powerfully about the freedom to invent a new world. In this speech, there was no mention of the deity. Second example underscores a similar contrast. Until the recent past, Canada's constitutional existence had been embodied, enfolded in the common law traditions of the British Parliament, before which Americans, with our penchant for thinking that a constitutional democracy actually requires a written constitution, stand in clueless bemusement. Yet, as all of you know, in 1982, after painstaking exertions by Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Canada, with the relieved cooperation of the British Parliament, finally took control of its own constitution. Even at that relatively late date, public theism remained prominent in Canada's new charters of rights and freedoms, which famously at the start referred to Canada's trust in God and the rule of law. The inclusion of such an affirmation in the charter did not, however, presage a resurgence of traditional Christianity, for under the new charter, Canadian legislation and jurisprudence have increasingly privileged principles of privacy, multiculturalism, enforced toleration, and public religious neutrality, even when such moves de-Christianize public spaces in which religious language was once commonplace. Education is another example of significant change. In a major study of Ontario public schools, R.D. Gidney and W.P.J. Millar talked about how central Christian doctrines were in Ontario's public schools, albeit in a non-denominational Protestant form, well in the mid-20th century, and how these emphases on Christianity were still alive as late as the mid-1960s. But their conclusion about recent changes is underscores dramatic change. They have written, "In this particular part of the public arena, Christianity has not only been disestablished but banished." Another mark of strong difference with the United States: the Canadian Parliament voted on June 28, 2005, to legalize same-sex marriage throughout all of Canada. This action followed by 2 years, a decision of the Ontario Court of Appeals that the Charter of Rights and Freedom authorized marriage for any two people, regardless of gender. When the federal legislation became the law of the land in July 2005, there was minimal public notice, with the only sustained political reservation the Conservative Party's stated desire that Parliament reconsider its vote. contrast is striking with the United States, where judicial actions by various state courts have made rulings similar to Ontario's court decision, but these decisions have elicited storms of national protest. In 2004, debate over same-sex marriage became a highly charged factor in many regions during the elections of that year. In Canada, the redefinition of marriage, which had been unthinkable short decades ago, has been widely, if not universally, accepted. In the United States, the unthinkable has become the contested. Broad measures of church adherence underscore the magnitude of Canadian religious change over recent decades. As late as 1961, only 0.5% of Canadian citizens told census takers that they were not attached to any religious body. That proportion rose to over 4% in 1971, and in 2001 stood at over 16%. Over the same four decades, the proportion of Canadians telling census personnel that they were part of the Catholic Church declined from 46% to 43%, while the proportion of Canadians claiming a connection to Anglican, Baptist, Presbyterian, and United churches, the four largest Protestant denominations that had long dominated religious life in English-speaking Canada, fell precipitously from 41% to 20%. Reports of church attendance offer an equally dramatic picture. After World War II, when the Gallup poll first asked Canadians whether they had been in church or synagogue sometime during the previous 7 days, a full 67% of Canadians responded positively. Among all Canadian Catholics, the number was a robust 83%, and in Quebec, a stratospheric 90%. In the early 1960s, weekly mass attendance in the rapidly growing cities of Montreal and Quebec remained quite high, but some leaders worried openly that in working-class neighborhoods, mass attendance was down to only 50%. By 1990, positive response to the Gallup question had fallen to 23% throughout Canada. Although the foremost Canadian religious demographer, Reginald Bibby, has recently noted some increase in attendance, his non-Gallup calculations chart a weekly attendance rate for the year 2000 of less than 20%. Numbers, of course, have to be interpreted, but these findings about church identification and church attendance nonetheless indicate a series of shifts in Canadian religion that have not taken place in the United States or have taken place at a much slower rate. Put generally, in 1950, Canadian church attendance as a proportion of the total population exceeded church attendance in the United States by 1/3 to 1/2, and church attendance in Quebec may have been the highest in the world. Today, church attendance in the United States is probably 1/2 to 2/3 greater than in Canada, and attendance in Quebec is the lowest of any state or Protestant or province in North America. Over the course of only a half a century, these figures represent a dramatic inversion. This inversion, and the history of the last 60 years that created it, could not have been imagined in the years immediately after the Second World War. At that time, the vigor of Canadian religious practice seemed entirely in keeping with the general trajectory of Canadian history. Not only was Canada more observant in religious practice and more orthodox in religious opinion than the United States, but these comparative results represented only the latest chapter in a remarkable history of Christianization stretching back to the 18th century. And what's intriguing to me as an outsider trying to get a handle on the outlines of Canadian history is that the processes of Christianization were very different for Quebec, the Maritimes, Ontario, then Canada West, but in all of these regions, it took place. And the marks of this Christian civilization that resulted included fruitful cooperation between churches and provincial governments in organizing education, social services, and eventually healthcare, noteworthy syntheses of traditional faith and modern learning that avoided the excesses of both secularization and fundamentalism, deep interpenetration of religious convictions and social values, and the outworking of family and community life in many localities, and not least, steady strengthening of the main denominations, which for most purposes meant, not always in Winnipeg, but for most purposes elsewhere in Canada, meant the Catholics, Anglicans, Presbyterians, Methodists, and Baptists, and from 1925, the United Church. The parallel histories of Quebec and the rest of Canada left Canada at the mid-20th century with a much stronger claim as a Christian nation than its large neighbor to the south. At least that is until the generation after the Second World War, when things began to change, and to change in a hurry. So, what happened? Why did a nation in which until about 1960 almost all measures of Christian faith and practice were stronger than in the United States almost overnight become a nation in which such measures became noticeably weaker? Why, given the sharp historical divisions between Canada's two solitudes, French-speaking Catholic Quebec and English-speaking rest of the nation decisively shaped by Protestant heritage, why did both Quebec and the rest of Canada experience just about the same trajectories of de-Christianization over just about the same span of time? What can explain the dramatic reversal that Canada's greatest religious historian, John Webster Grant, once put in a single sentence? Realization that Christendom was dead, even in Canada, dawned with surprising suddenness in the 1960s at some time during 1965 for many people. What an aging priest in Dennis Arcand's recent film, The Barbarian Invasions, plaintively said about the situation in Quebec. In 1966, all the churches emptied out in a few weeks. No one can figure out why. I'll try to explain, but I'm hopefully really interested in the last part of the hour today when you folks get to say what you think. A good beginning point for explanation was provided in 1990 by Seymour Martin Lipset, who wrote the book Continental Divide, which is still one of the most thoughtful comparative studies of its kind. Lipset's main argument was that Canada has been and is a more class-aware, elitist, law-abiding, statist, collectivity-oriented, and group-oriented society than the United States. The anti-statism, individualism, populism, violence, and egalitarianism that characterize American history have been decidedly less prominent in Canada. Where Canada has stressed the state and community values, the United States has featured the individual and laissez-faire. In contrast to the American embrace of individualistic liberalism, Canada has fostered a public attitude stressing commonalities, whether Tory statist on the right or social democratic on the left. According to Lipset, the reasons for these systematic differences are both geographical and historical. Canada's vast space and sparse population have required a more active government and have placed a premium upon cooperation. Historically, the first move was most important. In the 1770s, Canadians rejected the American Revolution and were set on a less republican course in both Quebec, where bishops and people remained loyal to Britain despite American diplomacy and invasion, as well as in the Maritimes in Upper Canada, whence many Protestant loyalists fled after being ejected from their former homes. Then, in the War of 1812, when the outmanned Canadians, with late help from Britain, fended off several American invasions, the result was not only a solidification of Canadian loyalty to Britain, but also a significant reduction of cultural influences from the United States, including ecclesiastical influences. In this 1990 volume, Lipset cited a number of indicators as evidence for his conclusion about American-Canadian differences. Canada's far lower murder rate, its much fewer number of police per capita, its willingness to tolerate higher taxes, its enforcement of nationwide gun control. The people at the border yesterday were really not at all concerned that I was coming to Canadian Mennonite University, but they sure didn't want me to pack any firepower when I came across the border. I've traveled to Canada many times, and it's still a nice kind of shock to be reminded that you have to leave your peace at home when you come into. Canadians have, in general, been content with high levels of government regulation and, of course, the single-payer health systems funded in significant part by the federal government and administered by the provinces are a difference from the United States. In the broad trajectory of history, Canadians used forces of cohesion to bind a widely scattered people, indeed two peoples, maybe three, into a prosperous, well-ordered, and reasonably stable nation-state. Christian faith and practice were critical in building this nation-state. In the United States, active Christianity also contributed materially to the construction of American culture, but it was a religion expressed more in voluntary and individualistic terms, more at home with the operations of a free market than in Canada, where voluntary exertions were always balanced by reliance upon government, and where free market initiative was matched by respect for received authority and inherited traditions. To move now from a very broad and sketchy glance at general Canadian history to the churches, ecclesiastical developments were always intimately related to social and political developments. I'm this morning, for the sake of time, going to admit the discussion of Canada's general history after the Second World War, but in all regions of Canada, rapid social, political, cultural, constitutional change had much to do, I think, with the changing space in which the churches operated and the changing effects that the churches had on Canadian society in general. The combination of the national history and the church's history is, to me, one of the most interesting things to study because of the relatively tight connections that in a non-established regime, but still a regime in which the churches functioned powerfully in public, set Canada apart from the United States. In the United States, there are always church leaders aspiring to be important in public life, but really very few, very, very few have ever been so. For the purposes of analyzing recent Canadian history, it's important to see that economic and political history is a history of de-Christianization occurring also with a church history. The social cohesion that the churches once provided is now offered by political and economic loyalties or by ideologies of toleration, personal growth, and multiculturalism. In the changes of recent decades, however, the churches have acted as well as been acted upon. These actions played out differently for Catholics, the United Church, Anglicans, and Canada's sectarian and evangelical churches. But in at least in my understanding of history, no actions were more important than those that occurred for Catholics in Quebec and for the United Church throughout all of Canada. From the 1930s onward, an eerie and even ironic confluence of similar forces affected these two great church movements. In both cases, an active cadre of intelligent and dedicated leaders promoted the same sort of reformist agenda over against the church's inherited traditions. The confluence is eerie because the Protestant and Roman Catholic stories were worked out in very different arenas with very little contact between the two. The confluence has been immensely significant because the Roman Catholic Church and the United Church were the most important institutional bearers of Canada's traditional Christian culture. The story in Quebec is a fascinating story and one that I know only a little bit about through reading several books. One of the fun things about trying to study Canadian history is that you get to practice your French, which will never be a language that trips easily off my tongue, but is actually possible for an English speaker who studied other Romance languages to read. And so in the Quebec accounts, it seems to me that there is, well, not exactly a consensus, but at least a reasonable historian's conclusion that the Catholic Church as it emerged from World War II in Quebec was strong, apparently, was definitely at the center of culture, definitely at the center of education, definitely still in the very first years after World War II in the center of economic and political life, but that the inherited Catholicism was also drying out. It was becoming sclerotic. It was not forward-looking enough to be adjusting its own inner strength to the new needs of the mid-20th century. By contrast, there were other groups in the church, reformist groups, younger groups, groups actually inspired by reviving type Catholic motives from the continent, that were on the move. In Quebec in the 1930s and 40s, I've been impressed with the appeal of Catholic action, with the movement, of Catholic action in a more Protestant direction and asking for lay involvement in the church, lay appropriation of spirituality, lay control over moral life, these appeals for reform by Catholic Action were often sharply critical of the inherited Catholic regime, but they were also clearly aimed at a revivification and a revival of active Catholic life. What happened in the 1960s, however, was that the appeal for change, 50s and 60s, the appeal for change was heard, but the resources of the reforming forces, which included strong Catholic elements in the Liberal Party, included as a young participant, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the resources for reconstructing a newer, more vibrant, more lay-driven Catholicism were not up to the challenges of the actual 1960s. I'm struck particularly by the international implications of this development in Quebec, since Catholic Action on the continent at the same time was acting as a source of renewal, leading, for example, to the vigor of Catholic infrastructure in Poland and the leadership of Karol Wojtyła in the Polish church, who drew on some of the same currents of Catholic renewal in the phrase Catholic Action in Eastern Europe that were being drawn upon in Quebec, but with very different results when the tides of history moved differently in the two places. The irony in the Quebec situation was that the new reforming Catholic perspective was successful at winning the mind of the church in the decades after the Depression, but it left the church in the 1960s with almost nothing specifically Christian to say to the radically transformed society of this later era. I'm taking much of what I understand about Quebec at this time from the McMaster historian Michael Govro, who puts it like this. In the process of articulating this youthful new Catholicism, its lay promoters originated the central cultural concept undergirding the Quiet Revolution, that a fundamental rupture divided the present from the past, a gulf that necessitated an entirely new framework of personal, familial, and social identities. In the admirably succinct summary of historian Preston Jones, French-Canadian nationalism as a cultural disposition rooted in Quebec's Catholic history was transformed into Quebecois separatism as a secular faith founded upon an aspiration for political salvation from the influences of the English. In a word, the personalism of social Catholicism had captured, but it could not feed, the soul of Quebec. The story of the United Church points to a strikingly similar conclusion, though the plot unfolds against strikingly different terrain. Throughout the 19th century, the Presbyterians and Methodists, along with Baptists in the Maritimes and Anglicans throughout Canada, had provided the Protestant energy that built an English-speaking Christian nation. Both Presbyterians, with leaders like Principal George Monroe Grant of Queen's University, and Methodists with leaders like Nathaniel Burwash of Victoria College in Toronto, had featured a well-balanced liberal evangelicalism, which was almost as much committed to a supernatural God as their American evangelical contemporaries, and almost as devoted to the power of a social gospel as their mainline American contemporaries. In addition, both Methodists and Presbyterians had articulated a powerful message of Christian social order that, again, by comparison with main Protestant bodies in the U.S., relied less on world-despising individualism and practiced more integration of public and private moral responsibility. Then in 1925, after more than 20 years of negotiations, the Methodists and a majority of the Presbyterians agreed to merge into the United Church of Canada. From its origins, the new United Church saw itself as distinctly a national church, even the national church, that could provide the informal establishment that Canada needed to continue as a moral, God-honoring, and socially compassionate country. In the words of a leading historian of Canadian Methodism, Neil Semple, the support for church union was heavily bound up with the optimistic vision for Canada itself. If Canada's destiny was to have a spiritual and moral base, a patriotic national church must instill a common set of Christian principles, help preserve national and social stability, guide the country's conscience, and make Canada a legitimate model for the entire world. When, however, Methodists and the majority of Presbyterians finalized church union, they were denominations in transition, In both groups, a newer concern for social transformation as an end in itself and a wariness of former evangelical enthusiasm beginning to compete against the older liberal evangelicalism. The competition between these two forces continued in the United Church at least until the final victory in the 1960s of social collectivism and theological modernism. But the mind of the United Church was captured by these newer forces well before the church as an entirety itself. The historian Nancy Christie has recently provided a provocative interpretation of how these changes occurred by specific reference to the United Church's official stance on marriage, sexuality, and the family. Her contention is that the United Church leaders by the 1940s felt that they were being marginalized by the expanding reach of the new Canadian welfare state, especially as represented by the Family Allowances Act of 1944. In response, church leaders turned to neo-Orthodox theology that in effect repudiated Canada's long tradition of an active social gospel. At the same time, they also redefined the place of the family as private rather than public, as existing for the sexual and personal satisfaction of spouses instead of for the moral well-being of Canadian society, and as designed less for triumph over sin than as an arena for self-realization. By 1960, the Orthodox aspects of neo-Orthodox theology were wearing away, and the commitment to personal self-fulfillment was becoming even stronger. The result, according to Nancy Christie, was that the United Church's efforts to contain the expansion of the federal government had peculiarly liberal results in establishing the cultural precondition for modern sexual mores. And then, by 1966, after 200 years of forming the core of Methodist and Presbyterian theology, evangelicalism and mainline Protestantism foundered upon the rock of modern gender identities and human sexuality. The latent power of this new theology of modernism and ethics of privatized selfhood was heightened by the fact that traditionally evangelical elements in the United Church could never quite establish an effective public presence, neither in the decades immediately after church union, nor in the century's middle decades of theological drift, nor in the recent period as a counter to liberalizing elements in that denomination. The irony of this situation was that while a modernistic social gospel succeeded in winning the mind of the United Church, that victory left the United Church with little to offer by way of specific Christian content in the radically transformed conditions of the 1960s, when Canadian governments acted far more effectively than the churches in guaranteeing personal welfare. In sum, the ability of what had once been a socially responsible, moderately intellectual, Arminian evangelical Methodism, and a socially responsible, reasonably comprehensive Calvinistic Presbyterianism to make any kind of a sharp Christian impact on Christian thought, on Canadian thought, society, politics, or spirituality was fatally compromised by what historian Barry Mack has very precisely labeled the tragic failure of church union. There's a story, too, about the Anglican Church in Canada, which, at least for some elements in some parts of Upper Canada and Ontario, had, and maybe in the west of Canada, too, had acted as a kind of quasi-established church. I'm following the lead of historian William Westfall, who found that as Canadian Anglicans set their sights on exercising cultural authority through universities, architecture, influence, and social elites, in the mid-19th century, there was a consistent pattern of diminishing returns, so that the ability of Canadian Anglicans to act in imitation of the Church of England declined gently over time in a typically Anglican way, with no waves being made and almost no one noticing. It's a different story for Canadian sectarian and evangelical churches, and I wish I had more to say about this matter for this audience, but I'll just lurch ahead and be ready for getting the real story when it comes time to question and answers. By the 1940s, representatives of Canada's other churches were beginning to manifest considerable strength. These other churches included immigrant bodies like the Mennonites, the Dutch Reformed, the Lutherans, various Orthodox churches, and the Greek Catholics. More numerously, even, they were represented by a host of conservative evangelical bodies like the Christian and Missionary Alliance, the Plymouth Brethren, the Salvation Army, several Pentecostal denominations, and still others who were able to establish flourishing works in particular locales. More recently, countrywide associations like the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada have begun the process of drawing locally vital evangelical bodies or confessional immigrant Protestant bodies into some form of national cohesion. And always in coming to visit Mennonite groups in the United States or Canada, I've had some very nice conversations with Mennonites in the Vancouver area. It's like setting the cat in the midst of the dogs to ask the question, are you Mennonites evangelical people? And of course, some Mennonites are very convinced that who could be so stupid to even ask the question? And other Mennonites are also convinced who could be so stupid to ask the question, but with an entirely different angle in answering the question. What's, I think, perhaps a little bit different in the Canadian scene as opposed to the American scene, however, is that the tradition of voluntaristic, more or less, society avoiding, that's a bad word, but more or less separatistic groups, was never a major element in the stream of Canadian religious history the way it had been in the United States. Comparing Presbyterians to Presbyterians, Methodists to Methodists, Episcopalians to Anglicans, I think in every instance, one would have to say that the democratic, populist, and in some ways, bottom-up authority had been relatively stronger in these groups in the United States than in Canada. And then the broader terrain of church life in the United States had always been more open to groups like the Campbellites, the Restorationists, groups like the Mormons even, who were not dependent upon heritage, but were dependent upon the democratic skill, the entrepreneurial expertise, effectiveness of leaders in carving out a large space in the American domain. So that when, during and after World War II in the United States, fundamentalists became new evangelicals and evangelicals, there was already a kind of brew. That's a bad metaphor for these teetotalers, but there's already a kind of a mix, a goulash of independent acting churches that held a large space and were actually in many parts of the United States determinative of styles of Christian life, styles of Christian influence. By comparison to Canada, where when the Pentecostal, the evangelical, the fundamentalist, the immigrant churches grew to substantial size in the mid-century in Canada, I don't think there was a kind of voluntaristic, democratic, entrepreneurial space in Canadian traditions for this way of being Christian and operating as Christians in society. So I go on to say that even though these churches, which I do think it stretches the word to evangelical to say they're all evangelical in this sense, but when these churches were becoming increasingly successful and moving out from separated communities defined by language and immigrant experience, when these churches were becoming increasingly important, they did not have the same kind of effect on the broader Canadian society as Catholics and the older Protestants had once had. For various reasons, these other Christians seemed to be content with tending their own gardens. And walking around here a little bit this morning, it's a lovely garden that's been tended, in a very capacious garden that's been tended here at Canadian Mennonite University. Different reasons, I think, can explain this situation: ethnicity, language. Very nice to see German and Dutch periodicals in the library this morning, which don't see as many of those in American evangelical settings. For some of these traditions, a passivity-inducing holiness theology held people back from active public engagement. In some of the groups, what I would call, prejudicially I'm sure, a stultifying fixation on biblical prophecy had the same effect of reducing an effect on broader society. So while the newer to Canada immigrant communities like the Mennonites, like the Dutch Reformed, some of the newer evangelical movements have actually, I think, become quite interesting and quite successful in places like the Canada West, and even the more secular British Columbia have actually been effective with active congregations and active Christian institutions. The cumulative effect of this activity has been less, I think, than the sum of its parts. Brian Stiller is only one of many who have come to these kind of conclusions, but from his former position as head of the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada and president of Ontario's Tyndale University College, he's one of the first, one of the people best situated to make this kind of analysis. And he has written, "While maintaining their growth patterns and surprising many by their ability to attract baby boomers, evangelical Protestants' lack of involvement in the cultural mainstream has served to keep them from making a great deal of difference in the culture. Trapped for much of this century in a sectarian mode, a withdrawal from mainstream considerations and activities, evangelicals have only recently become concerned with what is going on in the public sphere. But in terms of cultural influence, they are all very much outsiders." From one angle, that's the end of Brian Stiller's quotation. From one angle, these Canadian sectarians, evangelicals, Pentecostals, and ethnic denominationalists are flourishing because they seem to have followed an American pattern, which might be called self-protecting atomism. In other words, a concern for the interior structure of church life and a willingness to live with that interior structure as the main focus for Christian activity. By attending to local needs and by not becoming involved in the national big picture, some of these groups have done very well. But from another angle, the American comparison reveals dissimilarities. The relatively small size and modest means of the sectarian cohort, the evangelical cohort in Canada, compared to the much larger and much wealthier cohort in the United States, constitutes a major difference. But so does the fact that voluntaristic sectarians flourish in the United States, at least in part, because their loose, traditionless, entrepreneurial style fits well with the United States' historically loose, less traditional, more Republican, and more entrepreneurial culture. Whereas north of the border, no form of sectarianism or voluntarism has ever exerted a major public influence in Canada's more corporate, conformist, cooperative, and monarchical culture. But I say a few words in the longer paper about the effects of the Second Vatican Council on Canadian church life. Obviously, it had a tremendous effect on Canadian Catholics, with the council coinciding almost exactly with the beginnings of Quebec's Quiet Revolution. But it's also, I think, possible to speculate about the effects of the Second Vatican Council on Canada's Protestants. I know from reading at least some accounts of 19th and early 20th century Canadian history that Catholic Protestant antagonisms were every bit as sharp in Canada as they were in the United States. I hope while I'm here in Winnipeg to visit the Real Esplanade and see up close the things I've read about many times with the revolts in 1870 and here in Winnipeg and then a little bit later in Saskatchewan. Louis Riel was, of course, not, I don't think, primarily an agitator of Catholic Protestant difference, but of course the Riel rebellions encouraged and precipitated and strengthened Catholic Protestant differences that were important for Protestant self-definition in Canada as well. With the Second Vatican Council and the increased possibility of Protestant Catholic cooperation, discussion, mutual learning, one of the strong pillars of Canadian historic self-identification was actually removed. This was a triumph for ecumenicity, but perhaps a weakening of Canadian Protestant identity. So, in conclusion, what happened to Christian Canada? Chicken and egg problems are difficult, but on this question, the British sociologist David Martin has recently offered a helpful insight in what amounts to a postscript to his 1978 book, A General Theory of Secularization. That earlier volume argued persuasively that when de-Christianization has occurred in modern Western nations, it usually takes the pattern of earlier Christianization in the same countries. So, Russia's top-down, czarist, state-sponsored, monopolistic Eastern Orthodoxy gave way to a top-down, Marxist, state-sponsored, monopolistic atheism. By contrast, in the United States, a democratic and voluntaristic Christian society in which churches competed vigorously with each other has been replaced by a pluralistic and voluntaristic democracy in which religious bodies still compete with each other, but also with all sorts of other organizations, including government. In a recent essay specifically in Canada, David Martin explains why the situation in Quebec, by comparison with other nations where Catholics had also enjoyed a territorial base in a largely Protestant society, and he notes how rapidly such a Catholicism has given way when it secures a parity of esteem with the surrounding Protestant culture. Similarly, he shows how developments among Canadian Protestants parallel similar developments in Australia, where the latent power built up by evangelical fervor was now being expended without renewal, so that conversion was translated into decency. In Martin's view, this Protestant situation embodies a near historical symmetry. The churches that helped form the image of a caring society for others and a mutual help were themselves reformed in the image of what they had created. To extend this interpretation, it was critical that Canada's most important churches themselves advocated, promoted, and facilitated rupture with hereditary patterns of Canadian religious life. They did so, moreover, in circumstances where political contention and economic modernization were creating breaks with a whole range of traditional social practices. Canadian churches, with their heritage of orderly, measured, communal, denominational life, were not nearly as well prepared for adjusting to such rapid ruptures as were the more entrepreneurial denominations, interest groups, and parachurch agencies of the United States. Yet if rupture with the past was uppermost in Canadian consciousness, the shape of that consciousness remained more communal and more uniform than in the United States. New public values replaced influences that the Canadian churches had exerted from the 18th century through the mid-20th. Liberal communal political ideals, stimulated by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, replaced the conservative communal ideals of Canada's past. Because Christianity had been expressed consistently in the ideals of a conservative communal social order, when that conservative communal social order was given up, so also was the Christianity. Rupture with the past, however, did not mean abandonment of a relatively more communal social order as such. It has meant rather the abandonment of the Christian presence that did so much to build that social order and also provided so much of its substance. So tonight, I'd like to pick up the question of Christian societies and whether it makes sense to talk about things in those terms, and also to offer some qualifications and some theological reflections on this process. But I'd like to conclude this historical analysis today with this assertion. In the United States, secularization has proceeded alongside of the fragmented populist structures of American churches. In Canada, by contrast, secularization has worked through the communal top-down structures of traditional Canadian society.